Welcome back, everybody, to the next episode of Film Music Focus. Today, we have the immense pleasure of having guest Mike Knobloch with us. And for those of you that do know who he is, you know just how much influence he has over the creative and business decisions that go into the music portion of things in movies. He is the president of Global Film Music and publishing at a very tiny little studio you may have heard at called Universal Pictures. Mike, welcome to the show. It's nice to have you.
Thanks so much, Justin. I'm happy to be here.
So your responsibilities, and both creative and business-wise, are vast in your position, to say the least. And a lot of our listeners are very well aware of the types of things that kind of go into the decision process that is all things, you know, from A to Z, but a lot of our folks are not. You know, they might just be general fans of film music or concert music or movies in general. And so, and I hope we can kind of take some time and talk a little bit about that stuff, have some fun, talk about the creative stuff. Let's start off with just kind of dialing back to your earliest memories of music. You know, what kind of made you fall in love with the craft, and whatever that craft was for you when you were young? I'd love to hear about it. I know our listeners would love to hear about it. And I understand you were a bando at some point, either in junior high or high school or both. You know, we share that awesomeness. So why don't we just kind of start there?
Sure. I mean, look, I grew up in New York. I'm almost a half a century old, so I'm a product of the 70s and 80s. Very interesting time musically to be, you know, to grow up with various influences, especially as a teenager in the 80s. You know, definitely some pros and cons to that era of music. But I was just always into music. Always, you know, I always kind of felt like I heard music a certain way. I was always into the technology behind music. I was always into, I was just fascinated by, you know, a lot of electronic stuff, recording gear, tape machines, synthesizers. You know, the 80s was kind of, a lot of exciting stuff happened with the birth of digital synthesizers and MIDI, you know, something we take for granted now, just being able to have, like, a communication protocol between machines. Like, it was a new thing when I was tinkering with all that gear. So I think a lot of that had to do with kind of my interest and enthusiasm and passion for kind of all aspects of music in general. And I think everything I, you know, kind of loved about particular kinds of music, I mean, I was into, like, you know, prog rock and pop stuff. I was into rock. I was into punk. I was, you know, listening to The Police. I was listening to XTC. I was also listening to Genesis and Yes and Peter Gabriel and Phil Collins and Howard Jones and, you know, Thomas Dolby. And, you know, it's just a pretty strange range of different kinds of musical influences. But, you know, I think one of the things that I appreciate, even though it makes me feel old, about kind of growing up in the era that I did, is that, you know, my world was smaller and my access to information was limited. And so a lot of it was just stuff, you know, if you couldn't do something, you had to figure it out. You couldn't necessarily go find the YouTube video that was going to show you how to do something. There was no such thing. And so, you know, I learned or taught myself how to play instruments. You know, I probably could have studied harder, taken more formal lessons, but you know, a pretty decent, like, kind of amateur player by ear kind of thing. I played in bands in high school, played in bands in college. I'm sure I was terrible on many levels, but it was just, it was fun. It was like, you know, I had friends who were into sports. This was like my sports, was like learning a song, playing music, getting together with other people, playing in a marching band in school, playing an orchestra in school, and you know, and just trying to figure it out. I didn't have a recording studio, didn't have a ton of gear, but at some point I thought it was amazing because I had a DX7 and an RX11 drum machine and a Tascam Porta Studio 4-track cassette recorder, and, you know, Alesis was making MIDI sequencers.
Yeah.
And so these really kind of crude machines where you could just sort of, you know, amateur multi-tracking and stuff. And it was just, it was amazing, but I didn't really know, how the business world worked. I didn't know what a record label did. I didn't know I didn't even know the term music publisher, but I certainly wouldn't have known what a publisher was. And I certainly didn't know that jobs like this existed. Yeah. Right. So, you know, just, I think along the way, just had to work a lot harder. I read Keyboard Magazine and Mix Magazine or whatever the resources were at the time. It was a pretty small kind of limited knowledge of things. And so I at some point just had a vague awareness that this was my world and this is where I wanted to be, but got to do it more as like kind of a lover of music and, you know, passionate enthusiast as opposed to somebody who could, you know, really dial it in a specific way, the way that you can do now without even ever leaving your bedroom, because, you know, if you have a laptop or an iPhone, you have, you know, access to everything in the world. It wasn't like that then. So yeah. I kind of appreciate how I didn't have that kind of access to all of that back then.
I think that's an astute point there at the end. You know, the perception that those that came up in, you know, decade XYZ, let's just take the 70s and the 80s versus those that are, let's just say, teenagers in their early 20s now that are at university or the college level. You're right. You know, it's like any of us out there in the world, we don't know what we don't know. But there's so right. much stuff now at our fingertips that we could very quickly, at least superficially, learn what something is. And it doesn't necessarily mean you're narrow and deep and myopic, which is, you know, what we all to some degree strive to be in a certain vertical or multiple verticals, which is how we become experts in our, you know, fields of choice. But there is that appreciation. I think that's a really eloquent way of saying it, because, you know, being able to look back, even if you're looking back 10 years, depending on regardless of your age level, being able to appreciate what you had at that time period versus what you have at your fingertips, either tools wise or technique wise, or, you know, the ability to digest content, which is such a huge thing now in the modern 21st century. You know, we can digest it so quickly and so much of it, which is one of my favorite things about film music, is that as a delivery vehicle, if you want to think of it like that, there's been no other part of the music business or music history at all, where as a delivery vehicle, you could deliver the product to both the singular and the masses so quickly and efficiently in a moment's notice. You know, even opera at its heyday in the 19th century didn't come close. So, so let me ask you this. Was there a time kind of early in your life where you felt like, you used the phrase, you know, dialed in, where you felt like there was one or two kind of focuses in the larger world of music that you felt like you really wanted to pursue?
You know, there was definitely like an aha moment for me, which was, you know, like I said, you know, just doing all kinds of musical things in grade school, high school, college. I ended up being a theater major at Northwestern, which is an amazing school. And so I had a real love for theater and putting on shows, and I would even, you know, gravitate towards the music and sound side of that. I did sound design for stage productions and wrote music for theater. And so I didn't know it, I don't think, as it was happening, but I was being drawn more and more to the intersection of just music and visual media, not knowing anything about like the real world, the practical side of that. And then while I was still in school, I got a summer gig as a production assistant on a movie that led to, you know, a bigger job that led to, you know, having my first job out of college. But working on that movie was really, that was more of like my kind of, you know, going to school than actually being in school at the time, because I got to be on the set. I got to be in the cutting room. I got to be in the office. I got to be in the trailer where decisions were being made. And I got just sort of fly on the wall, firsthand exposure and access to all these different, what turned out to be something I didn't know, is that these very specialized jobs, even to make one movie, everyone who was working there did a very specific thing. And, you know, going through production, I learned a lot, and then getting into post-production and being an editorial. And then my aha moment was, somebody makes music for this movie. There's a composer. And fortunately for me, that composer turned out to be Alan Silvestri. So it was a pretty great crash course into like a pretty high level of, you know, watching a film score get made And there was a music editor named Catherine Quittner, and she was cutting songs into the movie. And my job was to take CDs, which were kind of new at the time, to the transfer room where they would transfer CDs onto mag, onto film, so that they could be cut into the film in the cutting room, because the cutting room, even sound, was cutting 35 millimeter mag film. And so just that was so eye-opening for me. And really the aha moment I was referring to was all of that culminating in being on the scoring stage on the Warner Brothers lot and seeing Alan Silvestri on the podium and the orchestra being fired up and what went on in the control room, you know, Bobby Fernandez at the console and a music editor and the whole staff of technical personnel and the players and the filmmakers were there and everything. I just didn't really know. I wish I could say I grew up being such an avid student of film score and I was encyclopedic about different composers, classical composers and film composers. And, you know, I that wasn't the case for me. It's something I learned later, but I just didn't really ever stop to probably think about or appreciate that there was a whole machinery in the world that made the music that you hear in movies. And so from that first moment, like, I just remember when I saw what was going on the Warner Brothers stage with Alan Silvestri recording the score for that film, that for me was like somebody like landing on an island where like a language was spoken. And I didn't, so that language was like, it had been stored in a data bank in my head and I'd never spoken it or heard it before. But as soon as I did, I was like, I speak this language. This is my world. These are my people. And that, and that was like the moment I was like, all right, this is, I've been seeing and around all this amazing, cool stuff that to me was just, you know, the absolute pinnacle of where I wanted to be. But as soon as I saw the world of music, that intersection of music and film and all the people involved, which is a, you know, very kind of much smaller, very specialized community of people, that's when I pretty clearly identified, all right, I not only do I want to work in this business, but I specifically want to be there. I want to be at the intersection of music and film. And that was like the beginning of that very specific journey for me while I was actually still you know, a junior in college.
It certainly helps to have that impact given to you in to some degree by Alan. You know, I mean, his music is, what film was it? If you don't mind me asking.
It's a movie called Father of the Bride.
Oh gosh. That's such a great one. That's a great,
really
one.
Great.
It's great. You have this massive opening in the film, you know, where you have this size of grandeur and, you know, kind of escapism and fantasy. And then all of a sudden he dials into this really cool kind of like early 90s rock vibe. And, you know, he's giving you that feeling like, okay, you know, he's just a little guy. He's just gonna, he's got a family. He's rolling around town and, you know, he's 54. And, but I love that score.
Kind of Latin influence.
There is some of that,
You know, sessions with Paulinho da Costa and, you know, all of these great, it was just kind of a groovy, like, kind of. Yes, exactly. It was that.
48 hours later, the wedding was still on. We were on our way to Bel Air to meet Brian's folks.
I don't know why we have to have brunch with total strangers.
Because their son is marrying our daughter, and it's not an unusual custom meeting the in-laws.
You know, that's another thing. I hate that expression, in-laws. What does it mean, anyway? We're legally bound to these people? I don't want to be in-lawed. Especially the people who live in Bel Air. I mean, what kind of people have brunch and live in Bel Air?
Rich people.
It's good. It's really, really good. And, you know, that I was talking with him about this film not too long ago, and we were discussing the job that surrounds scoring a film that has such comedic genius like Steve Martin, and, you know, what that means for a picture to a composer, you know, because to a comedian, timing is everything. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm not just say absolutely everything, but it is, you know, number one, two, and three, let's say, and otherwise, what's the point in delivering, right? But it's not so different for a composer in film. So it's an interesting kind of, you know, so I asked him about that, and I thought that was, so that's cool, man. Father of the Bride, what a great one to be your first.
And look, you know, and it's like, and now, you know, I've gotten to work with Alan Silvestri on movies since then, and we kind of have, like, did we always have this, like, wink that, like, that's when we met. I recently actually found Home Movies, you know, I think part of my job at the time being the assistant to you know, Charles Shire and Nancy Myers, who were the writers and directors of the film. They gave me my first job out of school. I owe so much to them, and I'm still in touch with both of them. And part of my gig, other than, like, you know, getting coffee and food, whatever, you know, I could contribute to that situation, which was not a lot because I didn't know anything. And, you know, so I was just there to help do whatever. One of my gigs was to just document stuff. And I had a camcorder, and I have footage from that recording session, both in the booth and on the floor. And then I would drive over to Steve Tyrell's studio in Hollywood, where he was laying down vocal tracks on The Way You Look Tonight and things. So I was, you know, one of the, you know, three or four people in the room when Steve sang his vocals on that, because Alan was putting strings on it. And I think my job was to drive the tapes from Warner Brothers over to Steve's place, because of course everything was on a deadline. But, you know, what's been really cool for me is, you know, to keep in touch with Alan Silvestri over the years, or even, you know, people that I didn't know but were kind of knew from afar.
Right.
You know, like when I was in high school, I was in this band with a guy, and one of the cover songs that we did was by, you know, a duo called David and David, who had one album called Welcome to the Boomtown. And I didn't know anything about that. But years later, I was working on Moulin Rouge. I met David Berwald, who's, you know, a prolific songwriter and was one of the Davids in David and David. And it was just, you know, to go from being like a fan and being like, oh, man, I've mangled your song. And when, you know, with my crappy band in high school and stuff like that. And I'm just such a fan of talent and these amazing, they're all like rock stars to me. I actually met Colin Hay at one point years ago through work. And I think I apologized to him. I was like, dude, I'm pretty sure I played Who Can It Be Now at my bar mitzvah. And I'm pretty sure it was like the worst rendition of the song anyone's ever done. And I feel like I owe you an apology.
Yeah.
But it was just, you know, it's like, I still am so, you know, I got to shake hands, you know, recently with John Williams, who I've met a few times in my career. And that's just still such a thrill for me. I'm so in awe of all of the amazing talent that we get to be around. So it just, there's a kind of a nonstop, like I haven't lost that, whatever it was as a kid that had me so kind of passionate and enthusiastic and such a kind of worshiper of these, you know, gods of music, whether they were composers or performers, songwriters, producers or whatever. Like I still get giddy and you know, and geek out around people who blow me away like that.
Well, I think that's important, right? You know, even you get into your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, even 70s and 80s. I mean, you know, some of our heroes that are up in that range, like Bruce Broughton and John Williams, you know, you can tell that they still are able to access that part of themselves, which is what one of the things that kind of keeps them fresh and creative. And I think that's an important part for all of us to kind of try and maintain as we continue throughout our lives, just in general, is, you know, keeping that kid in the candy store moment accessible at all times. You know, if you can go there, you know, and I think that's a really cool thing. It's a luxury to have. Let's talk about for a bit your time before you came to Universal, and let's talk about your time at Fox, where you were for, gosh, correct me if I'm wrong, but around 12 or 13 years,
almost 14 years.
Almost 14. As the
I like the shorthanded
VP.
Is like from Titanic to Avatar, basically.
Okay. From James to James. And don't we miss him dearly? We miss him so much.
Yes, we do.
So let's talk about a little bit of your time over there at Fox. How did you come to be? And what are some of the things that you're proud of while you were there? Help us kind of understand what you were doing while you were there. That'd be great.
Sure. I mean, from the Father of the Bride gig to starting at Fox, there's a good few years in between. And, you know, that once I'd kind of that moment had gelled for me of like, whatever I do, I have to get to the intersection of music and film. You know, there's no direct path. So it was kind of like a zigzag of like, I worked for Charles Shire and Nancy Myers for couple of years, and then I went and worked for Steve Tyrell because I'd met him on Father of the Bride, and you know, learned stuff in his recording studio about making records and music supervision for film and TV. And then I had a next door neighbor working on this cool TV news program, and I never really wanted to be in the news business, but I like TV production, and so I went and worked there. And then, you know, after working on a news program for a couple of years and realizing like the production side's cool, but I'm not cut out for news. Working in news is like, you know, being good at everything I was bad at in school. I'd sort of hit a wall of like, I don't know what my next move is. And I don't know how to get closer to where I want to be. And there was just this kind of aha moment of, you know, again, you got to just appreciate the analog era versus stuff we take for granted yes. now as the digital era. So yep. connecting with people and getting people's contact info and stuff like that was just very different then. And I was in somebody's office and they had on the coffee table this special edition. It was the Film and TV Music biannual edition or quarterly edition of the Hollywood Reporter. And it was really thick and it said Film and TV Music on the cover. And in the middle of that issue, there was a thing called like corner offices or corner suites or something like that. And it was just a directory. It was literally like name, title, phone number, fax number, and mailing address for like heads of music and different departments and production companies and all of that. And maybe like the top three or four executives yeah. at every place. And I remember saying to the person whose magazine it was, I was like, can I borrow this? And I took it home. And I wrote a letter to everybody that was just sort of probably a very standard to whom it may concern, I want to come work for you kind of letter. And I sent them all out. My then girlfriend, who's now my wife, was doing all this graphic design stuff. And she helped make the letter look really cool. I think the letter looked a lot cooler than anything in the substance of the letter. Like paper was cool. The font was cool. It had like a cool like retro and like old microphone logo in the top corner. That's and smart. The envelope, like instead of like being a regular envelope that opened at the top, it opened on the side and had like a little string thing. So it was just a piece of paper that would stand out in a pile. Yeah. So anyway, sent out dozens and dozens of those letters. And I got one phone call back from a somewhat incredulous assistant who said, I work for a guy named Robert Kraft at Fox, and he got your letter and wants to have a meeting. And I couldn't tell if he was like the assistant who was calling me was almost sounded like annoyed that he was setting this meeting, or at least kind of like, this never really happens, but I'm reaching out to you because we got your letter. And came in and met a wonderful guy named Robert Kraft, and became the first of a handful of meetings. And I just, you know, bullshitted mightily basically about this experience. I worked on a movie, I worked in a recording studio, I'm working on this TV show, I know music supervision, I know how to make records. You know, Pro Tools was a new thing, and I had dabbled in Pro Tools and other sequencers and software that's no longer around. And I think I just kind of bundled that all together and said, therefore I have the chops to be useful to you, you should hire me. A couple meetings later, I guess he agreed, and he said, you know, he was only a couple years or maybe even 1 or 2 years into the gig there at Fox, and he was building his team. And he said, you know, come work for me. And I started as really kind of the more production oriented kind of nuts and bolts, how to kind of physical production guy within the music department. And the kicker to the whole story is that Robert, who is a proud Harvard alum, and was an art history major in school, he at some point, maybe years later, revealed to me that he never even really read the letter. He liked the stationery and he liked the way the letter looked. Cool, so, man. You know, that's I cool. think it's just, you know, it's a good lesson to learn that like there's a lot of ways to stand out. I don't know how intentional that was at the time, because I was smart about it, or is just trying to be as smart as possible. In the moment, I do remember Gary Marshall spoke at my graduation at Northwestern, and he was making a whatever the basketball movie was that Gary Marshall made. I'm forgetting the title off the top of my head.
That would have been in 92.
It would have been the early 90s basketball movie by Gary Marshall. But whatever it was, he was telling a graduating class of aspiring entertainment industry people that he got a resume from a kid who wanted to work for him. It was a resume that was handwritten on a basketball. And he hired the kid to be a PA on the movie. And cool. So it was just like those stories, you know, I think they resonate. But long rambly way of answering your question, which is, in the summer of 96, I started at Fox. And then just kind of, like I said, I just figured it out as I went, tried to cut my teeth. as best I could, learn everything I could, solve problems. I mean, it's all that any of us do still to this day. My value as an employee of a corporation is that I have, you know, kind of special skills in an area and I use them to solve problems.
Yeah.
So when you're just starting out, and as a PA on Father of the Bride, the problem of the moment could have been like, who's going to get lunch or who's going to clean this dirty car or whatever it was. And that was my value, is those are the kinds of problems I could solve. As I worked my way up, yeah, the problems got a little more sophisticated. And then over the years at Fox, I got to work on all different kinds of movies and work with a lot of different filmmakers and music driven projects. And, you know, working for someone like Robert, who is really creative and knowledgeable about music, and other kind of creative and technical people on the Fox lot that I kind of grew up with professionally and cut my teeth on, you know, the X-Men movies and the Ice Age movies and a movie like Drumline, where it's like Drumline is a great example of like, here's what it says in this script, is there just going to be all these cool performances by marching bands at this fictional university in the South. And just, let's just start with the, you know, like, how are we going to do that?
Figure it out.
Are we going to shoot live bands, or are we going to pre-record marching bands? How do you record hundreds of people in a band? Is there a studio? Do we make a studio? I mean, it was just all that kind of stuff that to me was always the exciting part of the gig. And so, you know, for all of those movies at Fox, Devil Wears Prada, Marley and Me, you know, those David Frankel movies that came out of Fox 2000. So the other big tentpole movies, animated movies like the Ice Age, what became the Ice Age franchise. And then even all the way up to, you know, my later years at Fox, but, you know, Alvin and the Chipmunks and, you know, and those James Cameron movies and all of that. So it was just, it was sort of a mixed bag of like, every different kind of unique thing that would come up on a movie to movie basis that we would just roll up our sleeves and help solve problems and be around some of the most kind of talented people on the planet in the process. You know, that's what I did for 14 years at Fox. And now I've been at Universal for a decade, and that's pretty much what I still do.
Yeah.
So,
you know, to your point about the stationery, you know, I think that is representative of a much larger topic, right? Which is, you know, how do you stand out? You know, how do you get noticed? How do you make an impression? And obviously the answer to that is an infinite number of things. And you never really know, especially in this industry, where things are going to land. I mean, it's such a people business. It's a relationship business. And so much of the creativity and the business side intersects with kind of the relationship connectivity. But to your credit, though, I mean, you may have gotten in the door perhaps a little bit with the stationery, but once you're in, you got to know how to stay. And
that's right.
You know, and there's an element to a lot of these really amazing stories with, you know, many of the people we look up to and who are successful, such as yourself around here. And there, for every one of those stories that, hey, this is how I got my start, there is another several decades of putting four to the floor every day and working and doing the work.
Sure.
And, you know, and I think that's an important part, and not to discredit the stationery, which is super cool.
Right.
But you have put four to the floor.
It's just
a big
reminder that my wife is the brains of the operation. And so, you know, if it hadn't been for her and the design of the stationery the letter was printed on, then it would be a very different story.
Brought to you by Cineconcerts.